the start of the jazz age, Kenneth Moore traces the heyday of the post-war boom, one of the most exciting and frantic interludes in 20th century musical history. A time that saw the golden age of American musical comedy, the birth of Rhapsody in Blue, crooners, the Charleston, the Black Bottom, and Flanagan and Allen.
The jazz age. One of those terms that you can't define, even though you know what it's supposed to mean. Well, what does it mean? Prohibition, for one thing. Speakeasies, gin mills, Al Capone, and loud music. Clarinetist Joe Masala remembers.
At one time, we were working at a place in Chicago called the Cass Club. And, of course, it was run by what they call the mob or the syndicate or something like that. And they asked us to play at a job in the afternoon. And according to the union scale at the time, it should have paid about $18 per man. But he said, all you guys are going to get is $10, whether you like it or not. Well, of course, we went. We played the job. They fed us well, and we drank champagne, if you want to call it champagne. Actually, what it was spiked up cider or something. And when we were just about finished, they said, well, okay, you guys can go home now. Here's your money. And we got paid. And as I was going, I was the last one out of the door. We had a quartet. I heard a voice say, hey, kid, come here. And it was Al Capone. And he said, here's a little tip for the boys. And he gave me $1,000, which was $250 apiece. I thought it funny that they would cut you down $6 on your pay and then give you a $1,000 tip. It was kind of cute, I think.
The jazz age enjoyed more than just jazz. Paradoxically, it was also the period of the most lush and sentimentally romantic musical escapism.
Deep in my heart, dear, I have a dream of you.
Was on the starlight,
Oh!
Nobody ever found out what it was the student prince was studying, but if he had a hape of the common sense which seems doubtful, he would have noticed that the mid-1920s was to be the last moment in modern times where the musical theatre was king, because talking pictures were only a very few years away. For the moment, though, the gramophone and the wireless were the main threats to a musical theatre that was enjoying the rapidly flowering talents of a whole group of writers. Remember Rudolf Frimmel, who once ran off to China to get married, and who got his big break because a rival composer ended up not talking to the leading lady? Well, Frimmel's operetta plots were even more ridiculous than that, and in 1924 he wrote one of the great smash hits of the decade. According to Irving Caesar, Frimmel would have found the whole thing almost too easy to write.
With Frimmel, you couldn't stop him. He'd be there for 8 hours, improvising. He'd say, Irving, you want to hear a concerto? And he'd improvise a concerto. That's a fact. Just a cataract of talent of music.
What Irving Caesar meant was that music poured out of Frimmel. And in 1924, he wrote Rose Marie. Edith Day, who starred in the London production, describes what it was like.
Rose Marie was above all romantic. It cut right across the hard-boiled, jazzed-up gaiety of the mid-20s. It was American, I think the first American musical ever seen at Drury Lane. So its music had a flavor, well, just a touch of syncopation here and there. Yet it had sentiment and glamour, just as the old-time musical plays like The Merry Widow. It ran for over 2 years, 851 performances, and I loved every one of them. That seemed to show that the public was perhaps a little tired of the hard-boiled post-war mood. And I suppose the famous Indian love call, which I sang I don't know how many thousand times, will happily haunt me all my life.
Well, I'm running you.
Great lover's cry from Rose Marie, the Indian love call, or as it's been called by semi-literate sopranos, when I'm calling you, double O, double O. Frimmel was related in the artistic sense to writers like Otto Harbach and Sigmund Romberg, whose shows presented the vision of life seen through the cloud of steam rising from a plate of goulash. Romberg was one of those Hungarians who wrote music for the English language musicals without ever really understanding English very well. Some people said he even had trouble with Hungarian. His great mid-1920s triumph was all about a heroine so boneheaded that during the show she falls in love with two different men without realizing that they're only one man after all. Not that Ziggy Romberg would have noticed. That is, not if the songwriter Leo Robin knows his man.
Hammerstein and Romberg were working together, and he gave Oscar a melody to take home and work on, and Oscar worked on it for days and days and days, and finally got something that he thought was great. And he brought it in and he said, here it is, Rami. How do you like it? Rami sat down at the piano, played it over and said, it fits.
One alone.
To be
One Alone from the Desert Song. Although the number of times the leading lady falls in love during the show, perhaps they should have called it Three Alone. Never mind, Sigmund Romberg could afford to laugh. His music was genuinely commercial, which wasn't true of the New Orleans jazz pioneers battling their way north and slowly, very slowly, winning a degree of popular approval. In 1917, the United States government, finally fed up with the number of U.S. sailors found lying in the New Orleans gutters with empty wallets, closed down the local red light district. So the jazz migration north began. A young black girl called Lil Hardin remembers what it was like to be noticed by the great Joe King Oliver.
He had heard about me, so when he came to Chicago, he asked me would I join his band. And oh boy, was I flattered, because I had heard about King Oliver, you know. And I said, oh, King Oliver wants me to play with him, you know. And he had heard about me, he wanted me to play with him too, because I was kind of favored in Chicago then. And so I joined Oliver's band, and we went to work at the Royal Garden.
It wasn't long before Lil Hardin was not only in the King Oliver band, but also married to its most famous member. His name was Louis Armstrong, and it's clear he worshipped King Oliver.
Everything he did. When I eat red beans and rice with him at his house, and he had a big tin bucket full of sweetened water, just sugar and water. He didn't want coffee and all that. Just a big bucket of sweetened water to rinse them beans down. His wife, Miss Oliver, made me a little bucket, too, like the three little bears. I had my little bucket, too. Because Joe Oliver, whatever he did, I wanted to do. All that was music. He never told me yet. He catch me on the street. All that cat's too busy to I'm around 17 years old. With my lesson, I run it to him. The rest of the cats, they go into the Eagle Saloon. I ain't got time, boy. But Joe Oliver stops and, no, you're dividing that wrong. Where he go into the saloon and have his drink. So you got to love him. They were too great. So like this little kid, yeah. They were too great, or just a little shaver.
Thank you.
In time, of course, Louis Armstrong was to bridge the gap between real jazz and popular music. But what about the bridge going the other way, from popular music to the concert hall? The bridge builder here was a band leader. In a sense, the first of all the modern band leaders, Paul Whiteman. And if you'd like to know whether he was an authentic big band leader, the answer is very definitely yes. He weighed about 20 stone, and they don't come much bigger than that. Whiteman was one of the first of the showbiz artists to find his fortunes on the still newfangled gramophone record, as the one-time Whiteman trumpeter Charlie Teagarden recalls.
See what happened to Paul. The very first record that he ever made with his big band, and when he first went to New York, was an old thing called Whispering. Now, up to that time, phonograph records had never been like tremendous sellers. If a band or an artist, even Caruso, will say, if they had a record that sold 15 or 20,000, that was a big deal. But Paul made this record of Whispering, and Japanese Sandman on the other side, and it sold 3 million records for Victor. And at that time, they had no royalty set up the way they do now. They split everything one-third apiece, one-third to the band, one-third to the writers, and one-third to the company. And records at that time sold for a dollar apiece, which is what Victor charged. So 3 million records is $3 million, and one-third of that went to Paul, which was 1 million. And in the days before taxes and all this, he had a million. So he was 28 years old. He was a millionaire. And that's the way things happened to him.
Whispering, a recording that made $1 million for Paul Whiteman. But the interesting thing about him is that he came from what you might call the classical side of the fence. A violinist from Denver, Colorado, he played the thing so badly himself that one of the violinists in the orchestra, the famous Joe Venuti, once stood up in the middle of a radio show and chewed up the boss's instrument rather than endure the agony of hearing him play it. But though Whiteman wasn't the greatest player himself, what he was good at was delegating authority to people who were. And in January 1924, this knack of finding gifted young men led to one of the most celebrated musical events of the century. But if you're going to try arranging a marriage between jazz and the classics, you have to make quite sure you can find the players who can make sense of both styles. Which brings us to a certain clarinet virtuoso remembered by Chappie D'Amato.
Whiteman's great player was Russ Gorman. And a funny thing about Russ Gorman, he played the bagpipes too. And this was his double act he used to do once. And then Whiteman saw him and got him in the band, like he did with Bing Crosby, the Rhythm Boys, In those days, you had a band, you could get people to come in it, and they could step out of the band and make a success, get all the applause.
Ross Gorman, playing the famous opening strains of the most popular concert work written this century, with the composer George Gershwin at the piano. And it was Paul Whiteman who cooked up the whole idea.
Many years ago, I had felt that I'd like to give a jazz concert. And I met George Gershwin, and who was a kindred spirit, and we both felt that maybe once a year, even in the hallowed halls of the symphony, maybe jazz could come in and play a rather important jazz work. I'm pretty mouthy, and I talked about this for a couple of years and didn't give the concert. And George and I talked about it many times and had decided on the title, which would be The Rhapsody in Blue, because I felt that, and George agreed with me, that it would be silly to write a symphony which demands certain form. Architecturally, it's pretty complicated, and it doesn't allow too much free movement. And a rhapsody, of course, means that you can rhapsodize, you can wander all around, and as I said, we talked about it a great deal. One day, my manager came to me and said, "Hey, your biggest competitor has just hired the Metropolitan Opera House and is going to give a jazz concert." And I said, "Over my dead body." Pretty much body in those days, too. I think I weighed 327 pounds. So I went around looking for a hall, and I couldn't find one. And I finally was able to get Aeolian Hall, but only one day in the whole calendar, practically. And that was the afternoon of Lincoln's birthday. That would be February 12th, 1924. So I immediately hired the hall, and then I called the newspapers up and told them that I was going to get the concert, which would be the first jazz concert, which was the first jazz concert. And I get home around 4 o'clock, and I barely got to sleep at about 6 o'clock when George Gershwin called me up. I guess he'd been restless and went down the corner and got the paper and came back and read it. And he said, "Hey, I see you're going to give your jazz concert." I said, "That's right." But he said, you expect me to do the Rhapsody in Blue? And I said, "That's right." But he said, "It's within 2 weeks." And I said, "You're right again. That's three times. You're in instead of out." And he said, "Well, you know, it would take me at least 6 months to gather this important thematic material for such a very important work." "Oh," I said, "you're talking like us symphony fellows now. You better put up your hair, because hot or cold, the body goes out in 2 weeks." And I said, "You've been thinking about it for a couple of years. You must have a lot of ideas." Well, he started to work, and each night he would bring us a page of the composition to the Palais Royal when we would finish. Freddie Grofe would orchestrate it that night. We would rehearse it the next day, and I can honestly say that when he dotted the last note, we were only one dot behind him. We were ready to play it.
Thank you.
Rhapsody in Blue. George Gershwin's first concert hall venture, although by no means his only hit of 1924. George had been writing hits for years, but for a long time he never realized that the best lyric writer available was in his own family. His name was Ira Gershwin, and by 1924 the brothers had formed a family partnership that was to sweep the board on Broadway and in time in Hollywood too. Ira, who wrote the words, was as self-effacing as George was spectacular and extrovert. And the mixture worked wonders a few months after the triumphant premiere of Rhapsody in Blue with another kind of premiere altogether, the first Gershwin Brothers musical, Lady Be Good, with lyrics by the modest Ira.
In person, my brother was a good deal like his music, vibrant, dynamic, and honest, and, if I may, charming. He was full of life and lived a full day. Although most of it was devoted to the piano and his music, it was a continual source of amazement to me that he found time to engage in so many other activities. He was a fine painter, a good golfer, a discerning and courageous art collector, an excellent photographer, a wonderful dancer, whether at a ballroom or taking a moment out of a show rehearsal to break into a tap dance. And socially, he was one of the most sought-after young men in New York, or whatever city he happened to be in. George moved fast, lived fast, studied hard, and learned fast.
There's a little rhythm, rhythm, rhythm that's gonna pass through my brain. So don't insist that the day is fixed, but it'll drive me insane.
Was the music and piano playing of George Gershwin and the voices of Adele and Fred Astaire. And this is how Fred Astaire remembers Gershwin.
He was a very good friend of mine, George. And my sister, boy. We used to go on together, and he appreciated so much the young talent that was coming up. We used to go and sit in nightclubs and watch new people and hear music, and he'd say, oh, listen, how do you like that? Isn't that good? To hear it. Look at that. He'd get so excited about something. He used to like to have me play the piano because I'd play one of his tunes and I'd do a little thing with it that he didn't do. And he'd say, wait, what'd you do? What was that? So I played something and he'd laugh. Then he'd get up and he'd do a couple of dance steps. Very often he'd play the piano for rehearsals because he wanted to be around. And then he'd get up and he said, why don't you do something like this here? He'd do some kind of a step, shuffle around or something. I said, well, I can use a part of that. I can't use all of it or something.
I've got the you don't know the half of it, dearie blue. The trouble is to have so many from whom to choose. With your permission, it's my ambition. Life, saying me for wife. I've got to, you don't know the half of it.
George Gershwin's Lady Be Good, which finally arrived in the West End of London in 1926, heralded the start of an era when the younger school of theatre composers in America finally threw off the influence of the old Viennese operetta. English developments were very different indeed. The music hall influence was dying, but it still survived in certain entertainment outposts, and it was in 1926, that same year that the British were humming Gershwin's Fascinating Rhythm and Lady Be Good, that one of the most famous of all English popular music songs was born. And how typically British that the man who wrote it was hardly regarded as a composer at all. Bud Flanagan.
It was in 1926 when the Depression was on, and I was playing the Hippodrome Derby with Florrie Ford and Chess, and I sat in the dressing room, and I said, "Chess, I think I've written a good number." And he said, "What is it?" I said, "You listen." He said, "Oh, I like that." So we got the conductor, by the name Noel Vincent, to come along and take the melody from my voice. I can't write music. And that was the birth of Underneath the Arches. We went and we put it on the following week at the Pier Pavilion, Southport. And it's been one of my favourites ever since.
We've never sought for Savoy's, they can keep. There's only one place that we know, and that is where we sleep. Underneath the arches, we dream of things of bum bum bo do be do. Underneath the bum bum bo di da bo, on cobblestones we mum da bo 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 bo. Back to back with body, ba 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 di do. Tired out and bum bo do bo ba di do. Sorry when the daylight comes creeping, heralding the dawn, sleeping when it's raining. And sleeping when it's fine. Trains rattling by, hey, ba ba da be da bo. Hey, man, is a fee I allow? Without a sheet we lay. Underneath the arches, we dream our dreams away.
Hint of Hard Times that comes out of that plaintive lyric of Underneath the Arches was a bit too prophetic to be typical of 1926. Later, when the Great Depression had taken hold, it would be common enough. But for the moment, the world was still in the nervous grip of the jazz age. All over America, unknown young men were writing music that before long everyone would pay to hear. Richard Rogers explains.
Lorenz Hart had very advanced ideas about rhyming, and thought that all these things would be valid in the theater if anybody ever had the nerve to use them. And I was totally intrigued by what he had to say, and I thought he was wonderful. And, of course, he was an old man compared to me. He was 7 years older. Larry was 23 years old, and I was 16.
Isn't she cute? Isn't she sweet? She's gentle and mentally nearly complete. She's not just a beauty, a beauty, unique, a little girl's brain. Take her to dance, take her to sing. She's stunning, I'm cunning, I'm ready to be. Now look at the vision, and call her, and let her meet the girl's brain. She is smart, she's refined. How can she be real?
She has fun, she has fun.
Gosh, the girl's ideal. Isn't she cute? Isn't she sweet? And I would be dying for the pleasure to meet. In my party fashion, I'm just with the fashion for the girlfriend.
And, of course, the trampling on of the last surviving wisps of Victorian morality was done with some new dances that the dear Queen Victoria would definitely not have been amused at. There was one particular madness, for instance, called the Bunny Hug, another called the Black Bottom, and most famous of all the dance steps, named after a sea town on the Virginia seaboard, the Charleston. Useful reminder that if popular music doesn't make you want to dance as well as sing, then it's not altogether popular after all. By the mid-20s, people were just beginning to develop the habit of dancing to an invisible orchestra, the one that came out of primitive crystal sets and prototype wirelesses. A new form of stardom was developing, where names became household words through the sound people learned to associate with them. The first really important dance band leader in Britain to use radio as a powerful means of publicity was the Lancashire pianist Jack Hilton.
When I started my band, we still had a banjoist in 1924. It was a sort of survivor of the old-time jazz bands. You see, dance music was in a very interesting state of transition at that time, halfway from jazz band to the modern dance orchestra. There are 12 players, and you'll notice that there's only one violin. It's mostly wind instruments. There are 4 saxophones, 2 trumpets, and a trombone. A new band, a new style of playing, the new radio to help us put it on the map.